Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for my third talk in Melbourne. And like I said, for all the others, this is a disclaimer, because after walking through my other talks, they might change 100% completely between now and then. And the same is true of this talk. I walk through these talks verbally to get a sense whether or not I like them. And if I don't like them, I'll throw them away and start a new one. In fact, I've got plenty of rough drafts of this, but I haven't had the time or the opportunity on my little vacation here to sit and talk through them, but I've got kind of an afternoon because I did a radio interview, and so I'm going to make videos and I'm going to post them. And so if you're in the Melbourne area, please come. PetersonPhenomenon.org, and you can buy tickets. There's still tickets available, and I'd love to meet you, love to see you. So let's jump in. As with the other videos, I begin with a conversation I had with John Anderson. And I'm not going to play that because the debut is going to be, in fact, at the event. So you'll have to wait and see what that's about. And I'm going to play a clip from the Biblical series where Jordan Peterson gives a little bit of what he does. And I'm not going to play that now either. And give a little bit of review. Jordan Peterson has been on a status rocket fueled by the meaning crisis and the culture war. That was talk one. Why Jordan Peterson might be the most important person in the theism conversation since Darwin. God number one and God number two. That's talk two. Now, one of the things that Peterson says all the time in his biblical series is that he tries to make everything practical. And when Peterson talks about why his biblical series have been so well received, not only by some Christians, but by atheists and Muslims and Buddhists, is that he tries to keep everything as practical as possible. That has a great deal to do with his project in meaning, because as he rightly notes, meaning trumps happiness. Life is suffering. Throughout history, people have suffered for the sake of meaning. Women have given birth and mothered at the cost and risk of their lives. Men have fought in wars, given their lives in risky labor at the cost and risk of their lives. And in many ways, you can see that reflected in the curses in Genesis 3. Do what is meaningful and not what is expedient. I remember one interview where someone asked Peterson which of his 12 rules was most important. And this is the one he chose. Do what is meaningful, not what is expedient. And if you listen to the many conversations that I've done with individuals, you can hear that reflected again and again. A big part of the lift in depression is the rediscovery of meaning, that speaking the truth, that acting in the world, that picking up your heavy cross and carrying it is in fact meaningful. Peterson remarks again and again that when he talks about responsibility in his lectures, the audience gets quiet. And that is because taking responsibility inherently fills us with the experience of meaning. And in this contemporary world, we long for it. Well, why? Well, let's talk a little bit about sacraments. Those of you who are familiar with church, know about sacraments. In the Protestant churches, there are two sacraments, the Lord's Supper, also called the Eucharist, also called communion, and baptism. The Roman Catholic Church has seven sacraments. Now, in the Axial Age, and again, this is some of the Verveke stuff, Axial Age religions deal with the suffering in the world by believing in a world in which there is no suffering. This world is a place of decay, suffering, and frustration. What do you do if that is all you get out of life? Well, there is a heaven that is possible, and it's a place of eternity where time does not bring decay, where there is no suffering, where there are no tears, where there is no loss. And one of the ways to redeem the suffering of this world is, in fact, to hope for heaven and to work for it, to pick up that heavy cross and carry it up the hill. Sacraments connect us to heaven. In Christianity, Jesus Christ himself is the ultimate sacrifice. In the Gospel of John, most explicitly, he is the man from heaven who bears witness to the truth that God so loves the world that all who believe in him can have eternal life and not simply be subject to this. Now, this obviously is poured into the sacramental system. You must be baptized. Unless you eat my body and drink my flesh, John 6 says, you can have no part of me. Sacraments connect us to God, and this was an integral piece of, obviously, the history of Christianity in the East and in the West, and came front and center on stage during the Protestant Reformation that we'll talk about a little bit later. Now, again, if you go back to John Verbeke's stuff in The Meaning Crisis, he lays it out this way, as he's following, in a sense, Charles Taylor, that initially there was the continuous cosmos before the Axial Age, where there's just the enchanted world. In the Axial Age, you had the split world, and that, according to Verbeke, religions employ psychotechnologies to combat suffering with meaning, using meta-narratives. So, in fact, you can drag your heavy cross up that hill. There is a hope for heaven. There is a way to, in fact, endure suffering and find meaning. And in Christianity, I would assert, Christianity makes meaning, makes suffering meaningful. That's what we see on the cross. And what we see is the reconciliation of heaven and earth. And I didn't close that. Once again, this is one of my styled rough draft videos, so I will pause it and change slides and change things midway. And as I said before, if you're deciding, well, I'm not gonna come to the event in Melbourne because Paul's just gonna tell me what he told me here, well, it might be completely different. I will have the John Anderson talk though, and I probably will use that Peterson clip, but the Peterson clip could change too. You have this new continuous cosmos where, in fact, in the modern age, Darwin destroys heaven indirectly, and post-modernity destroys meta-narratives. And so what are you going to do with suffering? Can you find meaning in this world? And this, I think, is part of this age of anxiety. I'm going to drop a picture in there. Now, part of the way the church has had to respond is to adjust its tactics. And I've already mentioned the shift in emphasis to God number two over God number one. And part of this was expressed in moralistic therapeutic deism. But the church, in fact, has been trying to rearrange itself in the West in terms of evangelism for quite a few decades now. In the 1980s and 90s, you had the seeker movement, really led by Bill Hybels. And Willow Creek said, this is a safe space to hear a dangerous message. But you notice that worship spaces looked like secular college auditoriums because it was Bill Hybels' belief that crosses and that the baby boomers, if they walked into a space filled with crosses and obviously religious artifacts, that this would disturb and scare secular baby boomers. And he had a point. The seeker movement was tremendously successful among baby boomers. The music was pop or jazz. Now in the 2000s, the Xers, they tried to reach out to the Xers, and what you had was an emergent pushback on the seeker movement. And what this produced was two new flagship congregations, and they were both named Mars Hill. This was a way to engage a skeptical audience, taking from Paul's engagement of the Greeks on Mars Hill that you can find in the book of Acts. But it went in two very different directions. You had Rob Bell, who has continued to move out with his progressive evangelicalism, and you have Mark Driscoll with his young, restless, and reformed movement. Now neither of them, I don't know if Driscoll is pastoring anywhere now, but they both, in a sense, head out in different trajectories. And that shows, in many ways, a lot of the split that has happened in Western evangelicalism. Now, in the 2010s, what we began to see is that a new form, which was what I call neo-sacramentalism, and this may come as a surprise to some of you, but Anglicanism is the new hotness. Many pastors that I know would really love to be Anglican. Why? Because somehow the Anglicans have managed to preserve doctrinal integrity in some cases, along with weekly communion and baptismal font, front and center in liturgy. The new wave of church planting is all about re-embodied Christianity for a new world. Following Jordan Peterson, there's a renewed interest in orthodoxy, the kind of orthodox churches that are that came over often as immigrant churches from the old Soviet Union, and they've grown in the West. What's interesting is that some of the leading people in that area are Jonathan Peugeot, who's kind of been a partner in crime and making YouTubes about Jordan Peterson. And Peugeot is a personal friend of Jordan Peterson's. But there's this renewed interest in sacraments because we wish to re-embody Christianity because it's sort of been floating away from us. So you have a new desire for embodied belief. Now, fun shout out from Jordan Peterson via David Fuller. David came out to Sacramento and did an interview with me when he was on the West Coast collecting video. And one of the things that I had mentioned about Petersism is a stoicism in his teaching. And David challenged Jordan Peterson on that. And Jordan Peterson said, well, what's at the top of the city of the hill? You're getting all your meaning by carrying your cross up, but what's at the top? Peterson said, well, he hasn't been listening. And I thought, really? And he said, the city of God, the city on a hill. That links Peterson in a lot of interesting and different ways. Now, I had a little Twitter spat with somebody about Jordan Peterson's gospel. Well, Jordan Peterson doesn't pretend to be a Christian. Jordan Peterson isn't trying to do church growth, but part of the reason people are coming to Jordan Peterson is because he is, in fact, re-embodying the gospel in a, well, back that up. Jordan Peterson is promoting a re-embodiment of meaning. Now, many have noted that Jordan Peterson has a rather Augustinian anthropology. Own your responsibility for the suffering in the world. Don't blame somebody else. Take your responsibility in it. I just today posted a conversation that I did with Nolan Watson. And Nolan, as you can see, he lives in a wheelchair and a respirator does the breathing for him. And when he mentioned to me that his favorite book is The Gulag, I thought, my goodness. Here is a person who does not have use of his limbs or his body, and he is taking responsibility for the suffering in his life. And I thought to myself, if we would give anyone a pass on suffering and blaming, it would probably be someone in his condition, but he owns it. That's very Petersonian. It's very Augustinian. But now, Peterson's sacrament, his way to embody meaning, is to pick up that heavy cross, drag it uphill to the city of God. Now, of course, this follows Jesus' admonition to take up your cross and follow me. This is Peterson's sacrament. Is it a Pelagian soteriology? It kind of reminds us of that. I'm not going to go into the details of Pelagius and his fight with Augustine, but it's a very interesting combination. You, in a sense, save yourself and the world by moral action in keeping with the Bible. Now, in fairness to Peterson, this puts us front and center back into the Protestant Reformation, where all of these things come together. It's interesting how many of these issues that Peterson is dealing with are very much the same issues that the Protestant reformers were dealing with in the churches. And none of this is coincidental, because we're dealing with all of the issues that set up the Enlightenment and all of the consequences that happened afterwards. But the new thing that Peterson brings to the table is this new appreciation for the Bible as psychological authority. That's fascinating. Now, meaning is Jordan Peterson's sacrament. Read Maps of Meaning. Just look at the title. And read the book if you can. We were made for meaning, to be emotionally essential and pragmatically productive. You can watch his Maps of Meaning course on YouTube, and that's essentially the thesis of it. We are made for meaning. If you don't have meaning, you'll have nothing else, and you'll be a waste of a human being in the story of the world. So you have to go out and grab meaning with both hands, which means pick up responsibility. Do something hard. Don't just sleep with a woman, marry her. Don't just impregnate a woman, raise your child. And of course, for Christians, well, this seems to ring true. This is a very common morality that we're used to hearing about. But all of these loose ends of the Protestant Reformation in many ways remain in terms of the split between the Roman Catholics and the Protestants, which again puts the Anglican Church in a very interesting position. Salvation for Peterson is improvement in your individual life Salvation for Peterson is improvement in your individual life and for the world overall. Once individuals engage in their meaning, they make the world a better place. And I think this is true. And this is part of Peterson's point. And you can see the tensions with conservative Christianity and the Axial Age formation. A lot of this stuff runs in parallel, but Peterson is in some ways with Verveke and saying, well, can we really re-energize the actual Axial Age imagination? Are we justified in doing so? Those are the questions that tend to linger. My question is, what will be the church's response? The church is currently divided, and typically so, weak, and is currently and typically weak and divided. I did better when I wrote my slide. The main line is playing me too with critical theory, as I call it, progressive liberationism. Fundamentalists tend to hunker down. Evangelicals try to work the middle. Will there be a place for Jordan Peterson? Place for the Jordan Peterson followers. I should change that. Will there be a place for the Jordan Peterson followers who are God curious, Bible curious, and church curious? That's my missiological question. So I'm going to give a little bit of advice. This lecture looks a little short, so I'm going to work on this one some more. But I'm going to post this anyway because I need content and I have an internet connection and I have a computer, so why not? Be quick to listen and slow to express judgment. I think this is one of the key missteps Christians have made so far in engaging Jordan Peterson and his followers. If you already have your theological background, can you find differences between yourself and Jordan Peterson? Absolutely. Of course you would. Well, are you going to lead with that? Or are you in fact just going to listen? Take the time to learn. Think it through. Because finally, if you're a Christian, people matter because people matter to God. Invite them into your spaces to process. I started a Jordan Peterson meetup in my church, and whereas before any of this happened, churches tried how many silly things to just get people who aren't part of their church to darken the door. In this case, I've got people coming in, and what do they want to talk about? They want to talk about God. They want to talk about morality. They want to talk about what we can know. They want to talk about philosophy. I would have given my right arm for this 2 years ago, and here it is. And who can I thank for this? Jordan B. Peterson and the movement around him. I can't for the life of me figure out why churches can't see the missiological opportunity here. Well, when I listen to them, I can hear, well, they don't want this kind of people or this kind of man or this kind of message to be associated with them. And I find that instinct terrible because while we were yet sinners, Jesus died for us. So the core of Christianity is laying down our lives for our friends, all the way up to and including our enemies. When swords were drawn in the Garden of Gethsemane and Peter struck the ear of the priest's servant, Jesus healed his enemy and basically said, if anybody's blood will be shed here, it will be mine. This is our Lord, if you're a Christian. So learn from their insights. We don't know enough. The harvest will teach the harvesters. So that's it. I think all of these are, I might throw them all out and start all over. I don't know. We'll say, I never throw everything completely out. It's always a matter of editing. And again, as I'll probably go in with 10 or 15 talks in my in my pack, and as I get to learn the context and see what's happening, I'll mix and match and get the right ones. So again, if you're in Melbourne, come by. Love to meet you. Listen to the talks. But again, the key thing is find some people to talk to. Create a space where people can process. That's key in this, because in my experience, real change happens when people have the opportunity to do their own work. And if they invite you into the process, well, this is what, in my opinion, evangelism is all about. So thanks for watching. This one's fairly short. Interesting. See, that's why I talk through them, because you don't really know until you start gabbing. So see you next time.